By now, you've probably heard me raving about Osea. I'm obsessed with their Mega Moisture Duo, and I even caught my partner using it the other day because he smelled like seaweed. Now that's hot, right? You know who else would love Osea? Your mom, or your friends that are moms, or if you're a mom, because being a mom is hard work, and I think all moms deserve a spa day this Mother's Day. And what better way to make every day a spa day than with Osea's Mega Moisture Duo? And right now, you can even get an additional 10% off your first order with our code DATEABLE at OseaMalibu.com. Treat moms to the everyday spa experience she deserves with clean, vegan skin and body care from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code DATEABLE at OseaMalibu.com. You'll get free samples with every order and free shipping on orders over $60. Head to OseaMalibu.com and use the code DATEABLE for 10% off.
The Dateable podcast features real stories from real people of how they make modern dating work or not. I'm your host, Yue, former dating coach turned dating insider, if you will. On each episode, you'll hear commentary from my producer, Julie Kraftchick, and other surprise co-hosts. This episode of Dateable is brought to you by 500 Brunches. 500 Brunches connects like-minded people with similar interests to meet in real life over brunch. You answer a quick questionnaire about your interests and how you spend your time, and then they'll match you in small groups of 6 to 8 at a brunch spot in San Francisco. Get a free entry into a brunch now by signing up at 500brunches.com and using the code DATEABLE. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Dateable, a show all about modern dating. So we were invited to be on an episode of KQED's The Forum, where Kate Julian from The Atlantic came on to talk about an article she recently published about this sex recession that we're in. And in her article, she talks about how young people are having less sex than ever. And there's like a sex drought going on. But in this conversation that we had, a very interesting topic was brought up where she mentioned that one of the most popular courses at Northwestern University is this course called Marriage 101, taught by Dr. Alexandra Solomon. So we thought, we got to get her on the phone. We got to get her on an episode.
This I want to hear what this is all about.
Because the most popular course when I went to college was like computer science, right? It was like computer science 101. But people are much more interested in learning about marriage and how to make marriages last, which is great. I love hearing that. So we have Dr. Alexandra on the phone right now. Hi.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for having me on. Yes.
Thanks for coming on. I'm going to give a little background on who you are. She is from Chicago. She's been there for 23 years, originally from Detroit. She's married in her mid-40s, and she specializes in sex, love, and intimate relationships. For the last 20 years, she does individual and couples therapy. She teaches and trains graduate students to do couples therapy and teaches a globally recognized undergraduate relationship course at Northwestern University. She currently writes and presents to a wide variety of audiences and is a huge love nerd. I've never heard that before.
Self-proclaimed love nerd.
I want to be a love nerd. And likes to turn other people into love nerds as well. Okay, there we go. We'll learn about how to be love nerds ourselves. So let's first start with talking about this course, Marriage 101. What do you think it is about this course that makes it so popular?
I think that the topic is inherently curiosity provoking, right? And we spend the entire quarter talking about attraction, dating, sex, intimacy, commitment, marriage, conflict. Like it's pretty hard to resist. This spring, it'll be the 19th time the class has been taught. So it's something that has been refined over many years. And it's a hard, complicated class to pull off. But the teaching assistants and I work hard to make a really meaningful, emotionally evocative, thought-provoking experience for the students.
I find this so fascinating because we always say that you never learn these types of skills.
Yeah.
Like school and education, they don't teach you how to communicate with others and have relationships and build relationships.
I feel like college prepares you conceptually in the workplace and in life. But then it pushes you out into the real world and you have no idea what to do, like in terms of your human relationships.
Right.
So how did this course even get created?
Okay, so it got created when back when I was still a graduate student. And two of my mentors and teachers, Art Nielsen and Bill Pinzoff, who are couples, like longtime couples therapists, were feeling disturbed by the fact that they would spend hours and hours in their offices working with miserable couple after unhappy couple after discouraged couple. And they started to think, like, what could we, like, is there any way to prevent this? Like, what if we taught people how to do love, like, before they even had chosen their life partner? And what would that look like? What would we want them to know? So a team got together and kind of just like created this class from the ground up. You know, we have a really solid body of relationship science available to us. So in the course, we weave together science, clinical theory, narrative, and then a ton of self-exploration, because there's actually a ton of skills and background and paradigms that if you know them and understand them, you can just be more successful in love. I was a graduate student. I was involved from the beginning as a teaching assistant and a guest lecturer. And then maybe like 8 or 9 years ago, the class was sort of passed on to me, and it's been really fun to kind of like make it my baby ever since.
I'm guessing it's pretty dynamic content because it's probably changing all the time. So how do you come up with your syllabus?
The class is called Marriage 101. It's a little bit of a misnomer because we really are also working on, like, it could be called Hookup Culture 101. It could be called Sex 101.
So that's why it's so popular.
Yeah.
With college students.
Yeah. Because the thing that's happened over 20 years, you know, every once in a while, we still will have some engaged students. But 20 years ago, when we first started, we had more engaged students. So the biggest, you know, the modern dating landscape, as you two know very well, it's pretty different than what our students' parents and certainly what their grandparents dealt with. So I've really backed it up, and we really start now with like, okay, let's break down hookup culture and let's break down dating apps and let's talk about what a good breakup looks like. And so we're sort of filling in some of those gaps. I'm a Gen X person and my students don't get any older. You know, I come back through the class year after year and the distance between my world and their world kind of grows. So I work really hard to try to stay as close as I can to their experiences and bring wisdom and experience, but also compassion, because it's really tricky. I think the biggest thing we're all trying to get our heads around is the impact of technology and what that does to our human relationships.
What is the one takeaway from that?
Well, I think the one takeaway is when it comes to love and sex and hooking up, you got to kick it old school. Like, I always think about love as like this sort of like entity, like hanging off to the side, like laughing at all of us who think we can get super clever and use technology to do something that is really about like how somebody moves their body and how somebody smells and what you feel like in this space, you know, between you and them. And so a dating app can be used, I think, to find somebody, but then as quick as possible, you've got to go from screen to face to face and just like let the magic and mystery and pull of attraction kind of take you in, right? You've got to figure that out face to face. And we can't like technology our way through love. And I think the reason, there are lots of reasons we try to do that, right? Because when love goes poorly, it hurts like hell. Yeah. So the desire to be clever and cut corners is so understandable and so futile.
I feel like a problem we keep hearing on our show is that people don't give each other enough time because there's that paradox of choice. They feel like if I'm not clicking with this person in 5 minutes of meeting them, I can just swipe for the next choice. Yes. Is that something you also address?
It totally is. I've had students say to me, like, God forbid you get stuck with like an entree between you and this person. Right. But when we think about the thing that I'm always inviting and challenging our students to do is kind of flip the lens and imagine what it feels like that somebody else would decide that quickly about you.
That's interesting.
The big concept that drives the class and drives, I wrote a book a year and a half ago that kind of addresses this. It's this idea called relational self-awareness, which is a more important framework than ever. What happens when we swipe is we think, I just have to find the right person. And then that mentality can come into a first date where we think, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to, you know, I can decide really quickly whether they're for me or not for me. And the thing that gets lost is looking at how we're showing up. Like, what's the energy that we are bringing into that date? How are we being experienced by the other person? So we get into this sort of like consumer mentality, you know?
Yes.
And so I think for sure, attraction and chemistry, they take time to unfold. Like, you can't see my best self, my deepest self, my most quirky, fun, funky self right away. Like, that stuff takes a while for me to be able to kind of reveal and unfold. And so I think that's a bit of a dangerous mindset. And I do see that, yes, very commonly.
But it's also just about, it's that exercising empathy and knowing that you're meeting a new human being who's going through their own journey. And sometimes we forget that. You're so right about this, like, consumer culture that we're in. It's kind of like shopping on Amazon, shopping for people. If this is not the product I want, I'm going to look for something better with better reviews. When we all deserve time to uncover who our many layers are.
So we actually had another guest a while back that asked the question, like, do millennials actually even want to find love? Like, are they willing to put in the work of a relationship that older generations have done? What are your thoughts from talking to students?
Oh, I don't have a doubt in the world that that plenty of millennials want to find love.
Okay.
I think there's a fear that they can't, and there's a cynicism that sets in, and there's a really deep, I think oftentimes, like, lack of trust in their own resilience, and there's a massive skill deficit. But I don't have a doubt in the world that people really do long for just that, the sort of companionship, intimacy, like journeying through life together. I see that very commonly. I think there's a lot of longing and desire for that. It just feels fraught, complicated, and hard. Which it is.
Got it. So you think people, there's more fear than undesire?
Yes.
So what are the skills that millennials are lacking?
I am always also super careful to not, I'm not trying to come down at all on millennials, because I don't know that my generation or the generation above me figured it out any better.
True. That's true, because there's different challenges.
Yeah, different challenges. And this whole element of choice, like, there's such an opportunity now. Yep. To really kind of, like, buffet style, pick and choose what you want and what you don't want. So the degrees of freedom about what it is to construct a relationship, there are more of those. It's not just sort of like a plug and chug, like, put a person in there. And of course, you know, partner A does this and partner B does this. There's a sort of like crafting from the ground up of, do we want this or do we want this? Mm-hmm. Like, do we want monogamy, not monogamy? Are we living in the same place or separate places? Like, all these different variables that are so cool, because when you do create something that feels super authentic and super aligned, it's something that's strong and hearty and exciting. But it just means that you have to have the skill of relational self-awareness, which is like being able to basically look at what the relationship is stirring up in you right now.
Right.
I'm feeling whatever. I'm feeling trapped. I'm feeling afraid of losing myself. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling afraid of... And a lot of times, very often, what stirs in us in a romantic relationship is stuff from our past, stuff from our childhood, stuff from the love we saw growing up, problems that our parents had that we're terrified to repeat. All that stuff comes up. And so we've got to be able to, like, know how to work with it when it's not a problem if that stuff comes up, because it's going to come up. It's just like, can you work with it within yourself and with that person that you're dating?
And how do you work with your students to come up with these issues that they may uncover?
Pretty directly. I mean, one of the major assignments for the class is that they go talk to basically like their attachment figures, you know, the people who raise them, their elders, oftentimes parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles. They're becoming ethnographers, like trying to understand their own family system and like, how did my family do love? How did my family handle emotions? Because the more you understand the internal map that you bring into everything, like from like the first date, really, expectations about gender, expectations about touch, expectations about how you navigate difference, all that stuff is there. And so that assignment in particular is one where that's how you become a love nerd. Is you like you look at your life as this like infinitely curious thing, like, oh my gosh, now where did that belief of mine come
it's
from?
Really
that,
fascinating.
You know.
Well, because anytime you're in therapy, it usually roots down to your attachment styles.
Right.
And that usually comes down to family and the way you were raised or seen love in other instances show up.
Exactly.
And so once you uncover these, for lack of a better word, these issues, what do you do with them?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really, I think one thing is you accept that it's the work of a lifetime. So I'm in year let's see, my husband Todd and I celebrated our 20-year anniversary in August.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We've been together since college.
Wow.
And we'll have a moment where I get triggered by something mm-hmm. he's done. And my knee-jerk reaction is to make it about him. Mm. What kind of a person does that? Mm. How do you not know by now that that is a bad, silly, wrong, disappointing thing? And so the question is, can I pause, take a breath, and sort of like hold up a mirror and wonder like, okay, so what is it? If I'm feeling critical of him, what's going on inside of me? What's the unmet need? What's the longing? And how can I bring my concern to him in a way that advocates for myself without putting him down?
So what's an example? And could you walk through like how you would say it to him, how you'd spin it?
Julie and I are both like taking notes. Frantically.
Like your students in class.
Right. Yeah, it's really awesome. Like whenever Todd and I have a fight, I can, when it's like super raw, I can't bring it into the classroom, but I pretty quickly bring it into the classroom. And I'm like, okay, so here's what always a learning experience. I'm like, okay, I got another piece of this like really wild puzzle that is my relationship with this man.
How does he feel about that?
He doesn't really know any other way. We've been together so darn long. He doesn't know any other way.
So what's an example? Yeah.
So let's say like, I thought he ought to have done something and he didn't do it. Uh-huh. I would feel inside of myself like a desire to let him know that like that's wrong. And I might even make it to like, it feels like you don't even care about me or mm-hmm. don't you see how busy I am? That's a very common one that I slip into. Don't you see how busy I am? If I approach him like that, it's going to invite him to put his defenses up. Yeah, but you didn't tell me it was important. Or yeah, but you didn't do these four things mm-hmm. that I asked you to do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So attack invites defense versus if I could pause and just kind of like very often for me, what I have learned about myself is that if I become critical of him, it's because I'm somehow feeling guilty or some amount of shame about what's going on in my part of the relationship. And often for me, it's a story about, you know, I've got teenagers and I've got this like really busy career that I adore. And so I'm more likely to be critical of him if I've been having one of those days where all day long I've been kind of like critical of myself. Mm. You didn't get an Instagram post up today, or you forgot to do something for the kids, or, you know, you didn't go to the gym this morning, whatever it is. Mm. If I'm getting lost in my own self-critical story, I am much more likely to be critical of him.
Interesting.
So if I can pause and kind of like send myself some love, like put my hand on my heart, like send myself some love, that will help me. It doesn't mean then that I take my concern off the table.
Yeah.
But it means that I say to him, honey, I'm having a really hard time. Like, I'm so disappointed that this, you know, didn't get done. I'm having a really hard time. And that's going to invite him to be more sympathetic towards my plight in the world and feel more like a partner. Okay, so what do we want to do about it? Okay, so let's figure out what we're going to do from here.
So more of a team effort in the relationship.
Versus you. Mm-hmm. So what is the secret to a long-lasting marriage? Is it finding the right partner or knowing just how to communicate with your partner?
The thing we know with all this relationship science, there's no such thing as a conflict-free relationship. Think about all the romantic comedies that we've ever seen in our lives. They sort of end, you know, with the sort of like walking off into the sunset and we don't get to see
the
4 years
stuff
down the road. Yeah. And I think this ties back to the online dating is it then lowers our frustration tolerance. And we think the moment that there is one of those like pain points, misunderstandings, disappointment, the knee jerk is to just go back into the pool and find somebody else with the idea that that thing wouldn't happen if I was with the right person.
Right. Yeah.
Certainly there are things we ought not tolerate. Nobody ought to tolerate, you know, neglect, abuse, violence, certainly.
Yeah.
But I'm not talking about those things. But when there's that moment of friction or misunderstanding, the most successful couples are able to kind of navigate it with a sense of like, what are we going to learn from this? And how can I use this to more deeply understand you? And how can you more deeply understand me? And how can I more deeply understand myself? Mm. So that's the attitude that leads to a long and happy marriage.
Interesting. So you talked earlier that you believe that the younger generation and millennials really do want to find love. And you also talked to the point that the way people approach relationships is more like based off your own needs opposed to like a set script that has been in the past. How do you think people feel about marriage? Do you think the views have changed over the last 10 years?
I do. And it's complicated. Some of it has to do with really big macro factors in our economy. I think in order to imagine being a married person and pulling off the kind of interdependence and resource commingling that's required of marriage, you have to feel like you can stand on your own two feet and that you can lean on somebody else. And I think that we've got, you know, with massive college debt and systemic inequalities that seem to be only getting worse and worse, and this really big divide between haves and have-nots. I think cultures, countries, governments have a responsibility to create policies that people can support themselves and imagine like hitching themselves to somebody else's wagon. So I think that any conversation about like what's happening to the institution of marriage has to always be put in that bigger framework of what's happening around social policy, really.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. I never thought about it that way.
I have not either. I think there's been a lot of like discussions that people feel like it's like kind of outdated, like the laws and all of that piece. Like I've never heard the policy end, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. If you had to make a prediction for 10 years from now, do you think there would be more people getting married or less people getting married?
Oh, that's so interesting. I don't know. I mean, the trend line is certainly going towards less people getting married. But what I would love to see is us really creating family-friendly policies in this country and moving towards like creating more even playing fields for everybody and creating more inclusive cultures where LGBTQ plus people feel as woven into the fabric of everything as heterosexual people do. So if we can sort of like course correct around some of that, I think that marriage then becomes something really like beautiful and something that people can feel proud of and that it is theirs to create in a way that feels good to them. Like, but we've got to be inclusive about what that looks like what a family looks like and be able to like make policies that family can feel really good about and that they are supported and held by their community. So if we can do that, then I think for sure, marriage will start to like go back up again. People will feel more optimistic and more hopeful about what's possible.
Well, let's bring up the opposite end of this, because some would argue that marriage is actually not a natural structure for us. And it's a product of religion or a product of fitting into the way our economy works. How do you feel about marriage? Is this something that we should accept as a natural course of human behavior?
It's time to take a quick break so we can tell you about our current sponsor, Audible. What would it look like if we all listened more? Listening to audiobooks inspires us, motivates us, even brings us closer. And there's no better place to listen than Audible. We love listening to one of our favorite books from our past guest, Madison Perry, called Available, a memoir of heartbreak, hookups, love, and brunch. Hearing Madison's voice tell the story made it even more relatable, comical, and endearing. And now is the time to get that Audible membership for either yourself or someone on your list, as it's that time of year when everyone's thinking about thoughtful gifts. Right now, for a limited time, you can get 3 months of Audible for just $6.95 a month. That's more than half off the regular price. Go to audible.com/dateable or text dateable to the number 500500 today. Again, that's audible.com/dateable or text dateable to 500500 to get started. Now back to the show.
How do you feel about marriage? Is this something that we should accept as a natural course of human behavior?
I kind of like bypass this whole, is it natural or not natural? But I do think that when people are talking about that, what they're often talking about is sexual monogamy. We have historically tied together marriage and sexual monogamy. Those are one and the same. And I think what's really interesting and important and where I have had millennials really push my thinking is around like why do we choose sexual monogamy and what are the consequences of that? So I would say in the last 5 years or so, I have become much more intentional about saying that part of part of building a relationship with somebody, like a new couple, is they're kind of figuring out, okay, we're going to be a couple and what does it look like? There has to be a conversation around sexual monogamy. Oftentimes it is sort of assumed that it's the knee-jerk, natural, of course, is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And that is a setup for sexual boredom, for infidelity, for boundary violation, mm-hmm. versus a couple who is courageous enough to have a conversation about what does sexual monogamy mean to you? Are we choosing this? If we're choosing it, what are we going to do to keep our sexual relationship really alive and dynamic? And how will we ride the inevitable ebbs and flows of sexual desire? And I think the more we can start to put those conversations into voice and have people not be scared. Like, I think it feels like that conversation feels like it's piercing this bubble that is romanticism. And I think, in fact, the conversations like that are incredibly romantic because they're like, what are we going to do? Like, how are we going to take care of ourselves and each other? Right. And what are we going to do about the fact that we're going to be having sex with only each other for a really long time? What's that going to look like for us? How yeah. are we, you know? So I love those conversations. I'm all about supporting people having those conversations.
What about the conversation of someone who doesn't really believe in marriage versus right. someone who really wants it? Some, you know, the people who really don't believe in marriage would say, what's the point? Why can't we just be together forever right. and not have that certificate and not have it recognized by law? What do you think about that?
I would be so curious to have a conversation with them about how do they come to that belief? And what are the experiences in that person's life that feed and fuel that belief? And if it is a truly authentic belief system, then I think it ought to be respected. But I think oftentimes a belief system like that forms from a place of fear and from a place of seeing people in your family really, really, really screw up a marriage.
Oftentimes
what happens is when we see a really painful thing in the generation above us, we course correct to 180 degrees, which is really understandable. But what it omits is all of these shades of gray that are in between repetition and total opposition.
That's super interesting because I think one of the reasons too why people are getting married later and really trying to like hold out for that, like, by lack of a better term, perfect partner, which is like what you brought up earlier too about like the first sign of things not working, seeing if there's someone better, is because mm-hmm. our generation before us, there was such a rise in divorce. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about how that impacted this generation?
Yes. Oh my gosh. So many thoughts about it. You're totally spot on. The thing that I always say is that, you know, I'm the product of divorce. My parents were divorced and remarried. And so yes, being from a family like that does increase your chances yourself of getting divorced, but it also means that you have this like massive invitation to heal and learn and grow. And then in some ways, people like that who do their work end up being far more safe bets to marry mm-hmm. than somebody who just kind of has their head in the clouds and this like super romantic idea that you pick the right person and you trot off into the sunset. So there's data from Harvard from a couple of years ago that shows that about 70% of young adults 18 to 25 wish their parents had talked to them more about love and sex yep. and relationship and marriage. There's a massive, massive area of silence in families. And I oftentimes see yep. parents silencing themselves if they went through a divorce and their wound then becomes, I can't do love. I'm a failure at love. And so I love when I have the chance to work with those parents and talk about what might you want to share and how could you just, rather than giving advice, just make space to kind of stand shoulder to shoulder with your young adult and talk about all of it without a need to say, do this or don't do this or don't be like me or any of that stuff. It could just be like, yeah, it's hard. And here's the things I've learned and tell me what you're going through and what does it look like for you and what feels the hardest and what feels most confusing. That's such important healing.
And going back to the example of two people in a relationship, one person really believes in marriage, the other one doesn't. How would you address the other person who really believes in marriage? And part of what we've heard from people from doing our show is that you almost have to question those people even more because a lot of people are just born with the idea of marriage is their choice or it's the only choice
expected,
they have because
right?
it's expected yeah. socially and culturally. So how would you address that person in helping them untangle what is actually socially constructed versus what they actually consciously choose.
Well, yeah, that, I mean, that's a beautiful way right there is just, yeah. So I think, I mean, I'm obviously a huge advocate for couples therapy, and my students often laugh that like the biggest thing they got out of the class is like, they're now in therapy.
So start them early.
Which I frankly feel pretty good about. I think still have, I think we've done a nice job reducing the stigma for individual therapy, but I think we have a long ways to go reducing the stigma for couples therapy. And oftentimes couples wait an average of 6 years before, from the moment they know they need help till they actually get help. Wow. And I will tell you, as somebody who's been doing couples therapy for a long time, it is so much harder to disentangle patterns that have been around for years and years and years. So when I have a chance to work with a young couple, I'm super excited. And so I would love to work with a couple like this. I imagine a conversation with a couple like this goes something like this. If you love me, you wouldn't expect me to marry you. Yeah, right. But if you love me, you would just get over your fear of marriage and marry me, right? There'd be some version of push-pull and pain around, you must not love me because you don't understand how important this is for me. And so it's through couples therapy, we can kind of find the threads. And for the person who is hell-bent that marriage is the only way, I want to understand for them what that's about. And very often it's this idea that I'm afraid of being abandoned. And so my idea is, if we get married, you could never leave me. And so there's this like sort of false equating of marriage and
safety,
a promise of never being left behind, you know?
I could see that. Mm. So another area that's changed, I feel like, dramatically is children. Like, I think the generation before was almost expected, if you got married, you had children. What are your thoughts on that?
I have noticed that just again, like in the last 5 years, I have lots of, I have more graduate students than I would have had 10 years ago. I have more graduate students these days who say, you know, they're 25, 26, and who say, like, I just know that I don't want to be a parent. And that's different for me than, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, knowing graduate students, where they probably wouldn't have been as clear. This is something they just don't envision for their lives. I mean, I think a part of it ties to what we were saying before, like, at least in the US, we're really lousy at supporting families with little kids. And so I think this generation saw their parents like scrambling to balance family and career and doing all kinds of, I mean, working really challenging shifts and making really elaborate arrangements and feeling like there was just, it was really hard to get all the needs met. And so I can really imagine and empathize with that sense of like, I saw how hard everybody worked and I don't know that I can do that. And I don't think we're making much progress in that area around family friendly policies. And until we do, it's hard to blame people for not wanting to become parents.
Well, I think there's a perception too that you're like giving up your own self in life.
Sacrificing.
Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I know. Well, I'm super biased because I feel like I cannot even imagine my life without my kids. I'm so glad that I'm a mom. And I know that I have to breathe, like take a deep breath again and again because if I get out of my lane and I start looking at other people in my field, either who don't have kids or whose kids are grown or who had different, you know, I'm primary caregiver in my family system. So I know the ways in which my career is different and is smaller and is not as like, quote unquote, I'm not as like far along as I would have been if either I wasn't the primary parent or if we hadn't have had kids. So when I start to walk down that road of like imagining what if and what would be different, I just stop and I get focused again on like the beauty and bounty of my life choices, you know? So I do think, yes, it is definitely having kids requires a really different arranging of priorities. And my gosh, I'm learning more from my kids than they will ever learn from me. Like, they have taught me so much about patience and sacrifice and compromise and love. So it's not a thing that I would have traded in. And I think also there again, like if it's a choice that is truly deeply aligned, like I do not envision myself as a parent, I don't want that. That's very different than somebody who maybe feels really afraid because they had super painful, traumatic experiences as a kid. For those people, I would want them to have a chance to do therapy and kind of reassess. Is it a choice being made from a place of alignment or is it a choice being made from a place of fear and wound?
So if you had to give a very quick breakdown of everything you cover in your class for, let's say, a potential new student, what would that look like? What would someone take away from your course?
Like, well, they would take away kind of an understanding of the modern love landscape and sort of how it's different today than it was before and how it's different today than in other parts of the world. So we kind of begin with like this 10,000 foot view. We spend a lot of time talking about sex, and I feel like a lot of what I do is round out really, really incomplete sex education, because sex education in our country is really pretty deeply inadequate. And oftentimes gaps have been filled in by pornography. So we spend time talking about how do you come to know who you are sexually and where your boundaries are and what pleasure is like for you and how do you know that and how do you ask for that. And we talk about conflict. How do you fight fair? How do you make an apology? How do you forgive? We talk about expected challenges of relationship, like what it is to create a home with somebody and some of the challenges that come there. Oh, we talk a lot about what happens when love bridges cultural difference. Mm-hmm. What is it to be, you know, a white Midwesterner who marries somebody who is first generation from Pakistan? What happens there? And how do you work with your family systems and ways in which they're getting triggered? What happens if you are, you know, from a really wealthy family and you marry somebody where they're really, really, really blue collar? That's one of the biggest cultural differences that we don't talk nearly enough about, is how socioeconomic difference shows up in an intimate relationship. The students leave with a lot more language and frameworks for how to face the challenges of love. Like, it's not about making the challenges go away. It's just about making people stronger to be able to face the complexity.
You know, I'm just so mad that I'm the age I am now. And I did not have this opportunity to learn this in college, because, you know, I talked to a 20-year-old the other day, and she said, you know what I don't understand about our education system is that, for example, in math, they teach you a structure and a framework for problem solving. So they give you a formula and then you plug and chug, and that's how you do math problems. Mm-hmm. But for sex education, it's all driven by fear and consequences. Yeah. Yep. And so she said something so fascinating. She said, when I lost my virginity, I realized I was only taught about safe sex, but not how to enjoy sex.
Oh.
Yep. And it was mind-blowing for me, because I thought, how did I learn to enjoy sex? I guess through pornography, because where else would you turn to do that? And then the pornography enjoyment of sex is totally different than what everybody experiences.
Or dating. It's like you learn from these really terrible dating books that have been out there.
Or rom-coms.
which is like the rules and like shit that's like not communicative at all, basically.
Or productive.
Opposite of your entire course, probably.
So that was the point I got to when I wrote Loving Bravely, was Loving Bravely is a book that is sort of like in response to the rules and the advice about dating. And it's much more of like an inside out how to become, you know, somebody who knows how to navigate the dating world from the inside out, not because you've like learned the rules and the structure. And I'm now working on a second book, and maybe we'll reconnect when that one comes out, which is all about sex, because that's another, I mean, that story about the 20-year-old losing her virginity, is that's the reason that I'm writing this book, is that we do a really good job teaching people to be afraid of sex and associating sex with danger, disease, risk, and sin. And the thing that we know from the data is that the quality of a couple's sexual relationship has a really big impact on their overall relational health and happiness.
Yes.
But where do people go to kind of have like adult sex education? So this is the book I'm working on now.
That's amazing.
And it's been so fun and so like emotional for me. I cannot even wait for it to come out.
I definitely want to talk to you when you do this.
Yes, please let us know when that book is released. But
I think it's so fascinating, though, because it's like all the rules, it's like teaching you like a formula that does not work like across the board.
Yeah, it's not for real life.
Right.
It's for temporary games.
Or it's like, it's a game, and it's like tricking someone and like getting the upper hand. It's like,
how to be a scam,
basically.
Artist. Yeah.
And basically it reinforces the idea that I don't know anything, so I need your system in order to be okay, versus helping people just really be able to trust themselves.
Yep. And it also reinforces the fact that, like, if someone does something wrong, the next person out there, they're just not the right fit. There's more people out there because they're not responding exactly how you want them to.
Right. So if we're not undergrad students at Northwestern, how do we take your course?
That's right. Well, I certainly have I've got a YouTube channel and I have an Instagram feed and blogs on Psychology Today and books. And so there's lots of ways in which the lessons from the course are out there in the world. So there's lots of ways to kind of keep in touch and go a little deeper on some of these topics with me.
And give us your website.
DrAlexandraSolomon.com.
Yeah, we'll link it as well.
Let's definitely do some takeaways. Well, takeaways that Julie and I have, not your takeaways. No, what did you learn from this conversation? My biggest takeaway from this, and I've been dealing with this for a while, is accepting the fact that someone else's actions are just actions.
Yes.
And my mind and my brain is what processes that action into a feeling for myself. Mm-hmm. So taking that moment to step back and say, why am I feeling this way versus why is this person doing this to me is huge. Because that's how my parents used to fight. It's pointing fingers. Yes. That's what I grew up with. That's how my family has always been. That's what I've witnessed. But it took me 37 years to realize that this is not the most productive way of communicating. Yeah. So unraveling those 37 years of witnessing that and taking the time and effort to just pause has been really great for me, but also the most challenging thing for me. It takes a lot of effort.
I think my biggest takeaway is the statement that you said that every relationship has conflicts and that you just have to work through the conflicts, and it's how to do that opposed to trying to find this dream relationship that is completely conflict free, because that just doesn't exist. So I think there is definitely that notion, especially with the abundance of choice that's out there right now with apps. But I think it's doubling down and really just making it work with someone opposed to always looking for the next option that's really not going to ever result in a perfect relationship either.
That's right.
I feel like what I really enjoy with my partner is talking about our past and not just relationships, but also how are you brought up and how did your parents show love to each other?
Yes.
And being love nerds that you would call them, because it really helps understand how someone defines a relationship, what that involves, what love is, and how they like to receive it. And these are conversations we never think about having, because you just assume everybody thinks the same way you do, which is not the case at all. All of us are so different. And it's been eye-opening to have these conversations with everybody I've met, because you start to realize that love is defined in so many different ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this generation, I think the one part that's really amazing about us finding love, you could set your own rules. It's not this is what I'm supposed to do. Yeah. I'm supposed to get married. I'm supposed to have kids. If that's what you want to do, great. And if it's not what you want to do, that's also great. Different things that work for different couples.
Yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So to wrap things up, what piece of advice would you give to people who are trying to figure out what they're looking for? Because this is the one thing Julie and I have really learned from all of our guests, is that nobody really knows what they're looking for. So how do people get to at least a concrete idea of what they're looking for?
Part of it is letting go of the expectation that you have to know what it is you're looking for. And just, the idea of mindfulness is so popular in the field of mental health right now. It's such a well-researched concept. So I think that when we're in the dating world, big part of it is just to show up and just be really, really present with this person, and just rather than assessing, evaluating, future tripping, imagining what's going to happen, just be let yourself really, really dive into that present experience. And so letting go of the idea that you have to have chapter 13 figured out when you're only on chapter 1. I think that would be my big piece of advice.
So this is super interesting, because we've had other guests have other opinions of having a set goal in mind, i.e. marriage, for example, and kind of making sure that they're not putting all their eggs in one basket and like really making sure that they're driving to get to their goal of marriage, whether that be like having multiple partners at once or dating around. What do your take about the balance of your goals versus being mindful and present and really letting a relationship unfold? Because we all know it's hard to really get deep with a lot of people when you have work and friends and any other
a life
basically.
Maybe it's the word goal that I'm struggling with.
Okay.
What about if it was I'm really open to intimate partnership? Like I do think part of the challenge of hookup culture is people, I think women especially, sometimes women who date men can feel pressured that they have to act really chill and no drama and no expectation. And so I guess maybe if what those thought leaders are thinking is helping women be like less apologetic I'm really pro people just standing in their truth, which is, yes, I'm really open to a relationship. So maybe it's a difference between openness and goal. Cause I guess for goal, it again puts us in that energy of strategy, plan, and a little bit more like transactional, consumery. But I am definitely supportive of everybody, men, women, and those who live beyond the gender binary, being really comfortable with like, yeah, I really do want to wake up on a Sunday morning next to somebody and just snuggle. And I will not apologize for wanting to love and be loved. I'm definitely for that.
That is so refreshing to hear, because, you know, on the app Bumble, they have this section called looking for, and you can choose relationship or marriage or you don't know. And I hardly ever see anybody put marriage, because I think people think it's like scary to say I'm looking for a marriage.
Yeah.
But if they change the wording to open to, I'm open to these things.
Right. Is there one or the other?
Or not one or the other. Then it makes it a lot less daunting to just say, I'm open to these things.
Yeah.
Exploring.
Or I'm open to like describing your dream relationship.
Yeah.
Not necessarily like a relationship merit. Like that's so binary.
Yeah.
Those choices.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What about I'm open to really sitting with you with my 100% full presence and getting to know you. Like, can it just could that just, because that's where it starts from, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
That's getting to know somebody, and then everything else flows from there. Like I'm getting to know you, and I really like what you're about, and I really like how I feel when I'm near you. I really like that.
Yeah, I really like that mentality too, because like even if like, yes, like marriage is what you want in the future, when you're just meeting someone on Bumble, you don't know how to get married to them. Like, I don't even know who you are yet. Like, I want to do what you just said. I wanted to sit there and get to know you.
Yeah. And then you think, I mean, then when you go to gender role socialization, like we are yet to really raise a generation of men who would say without apology, absolutely, what I want is to be a husband and a father. Like, I think that there are ways in which we're kind of like stacking the deck against men, because we've been quite shaming of men naming their vulnerabilities. You know, I'm the mother of a teenage son who wants to read, who's really interested in reading romance books. Huh. You know how hard it is to find a romance book with a male protagonist? It's like nearly
pretty impossible.
Yeah.
I love this. I want to ask you before we wrap up one more gender role question. I guess, how have you seen this shift with your younger students?
I mean, one thing is that the younger generation is they're reconceptualizing gender in ways that weren't possible a generation or two before, right? So just everything around being gender queer and having different notions of gender expression, gender identity, gender fluidity, sexual fluidity. There's just a pretty new, interesting, complicated, rich landscape there. Heterosexual gender dynamics play out so powerfully around dating. And so whenever somebody is stepping out with any kind of creativity, stepping out of that, like, men are, women are, it requires self-awareness. So oftentimes my students who are LGBTQ+ are miles ahead of their straight peers around self-awareness and sexual awareness, because they've just needed to be. Hmm. And my heterosexual students are oftentimes, I think, quite held back by the heavy, heavy, heavy gender expectation loadings that happen around heterosexuality.
Do you find that like this, there's like this notion of like men having to like make the first move and pay
yes.
and do all of that. You still see that.
Oh my God. Yes. Do you, I mean, I'm sure you guys do too.
It's, oh yeah. Yeah. No, I was just curious because it's like college students. So it's even like a generation below who we're talking to. So I was wondering if that was going away at all.
Well, the whole like asking people out on dates is tricky on college campuses because that doesn't happen a whole lot. But the place I see it showing up is around hookups, where one of my students was telling me recently, she's a woman who hooks up with men, and she was hooking up with a guy and they were, you know, getting into it. And she said to him, can I talk to you a little bit about what gets me off? And he was like really like flummoxed, like, oh my gosh, no one's ever said that to me before, because his script was he just leads and he knows what to do and he knows how to take care of himself and take care of her. And so she was in that moment busting up the script, you know, and saying like, listen, my pleasure is going to be central and my pleasure is not going to come from, you know, penis to vagina intercourse. So I'd like to have a conversation about how I'm going to get myself some pleasure in this experience.
Interesting.
And it's like, that's revolutionary, right? That is bringing the, you know, feminist revolution into the bedroom, which is where it is much, much, much needed.
So one other last question around just the college students. You said they're not really asking each other on dates. Where do you see like the courting and like dating culture going like in later generations?
Well, I think that if we do relationship education right, it will come back around. So one of the assignments in my class also is they need to ask somebody on a date.
Oh, nice.
Amazing.
That is so good.
And it's, and it really, they just need a nudge. Like it's, it just, it's again, I think that fear of being awkward, that fear of being perceived as drama or needy, it's really quite oppressive. And so they just need, there's just is a need to kind of like break through that. And then people are able to kind of like ask for what they want, which is, I'd like to have some time with you. I'd like to get to know you better. I want to hang out with you.
Mm-hmm. I think that just to wrap up, I think that is like one of the other biggest takeaways on this is like just putting out what you're looking for and not being so scared, because if you really do scare someone away, they're not the right person.
Yeah. Putting out what you're open to, not what you're looking for.
True. What you're open to.
We're changing our language.
Or what you're like, what you want in a relationship.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Definitely. Okay. I love it. This is so good. I'm so getting a fake student ID tomorrow so I can go to your class.
And moving to Chicago.
Moving to Chicago.
And rolling in Northwestern. My cousin does go to Northwestern, so I'm going to ask her if she's taken this class.
Oh my God.
And if not, I'm going to suggest she gets in pronto.
Or we'll just take her spot.
Yeah, we can go visit her for the weekend.
Absolutely. If you guys visit, I always have. I've got mamas and papas and journalists and all kinds of people pop in on the class. So it's always fun. And the doors are always open. We get a lecture hall bigger than what we need so that we can accommodate visitors.
Awesome.
Oh, I'm so there.
What does the wait list look like? How many people are on there?
Yeah. It's not pretty. It fills up. Yeah. That's my least favorite day of the year is February 10th, because that's when registration opens. It fills quickly. The wait list fills. It's really hard to get into the class. Yeah.
That's
which is part
so
of why,
though.
You know, I've been writing books and doing all that other kind of stuff to help the material get out there in other forms. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not a fun process.
That's just so incredible, because for one, it speaks to how great your class is, but also two, how much people are willing to learn about marriage
or how much
and relationships.
They need
and,
this info.
But accepting the fact that they do need it. That's great. That's so great to hear.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alexandra Solomon, for coming on our show. We've been looking forward to this episode for so long. And it's just so refreshing to hear you talk about marriage and relationships in this way.
Totally.
I'm changing the way I speak about it and speak to others about it. So this has been a really productive session.
And can you just let us know what your website is again?
It is dralexandrasolomon.com.
All right. For all of our listeners at home, go on the website. There is so much knowledge to be learned, but also think about how you can apply to your everyday life instead of just learning the concepts. But we have to apply them
in the relationships in your life.
Yeah, in the relationship. Don't just swipe mindlessly. Right? And we're also, again, looking for guests on our show for future seasons. If you've taken a marriage class before and you want to share your experience, or if you've actually started a course yourself, we'd love to hear that as well. Definitely reach out to us. We'd love to speak to you. Okay, on that note, we're going to wrap this up.
Stay dateable.
You're
action item for this week is to think about your knee-jerk reactions. You know, those natural reactions you get when someone does something or says something. Next time, pause and think about why you get this kind of reaction and how you can change your perspective and mindset so you don't have these knee-jerk reactions next time.
This episode of Dateable is brought to you by 500 Brunches. 500 Brunches connects like-minded people with similar interests to meet in real life over brunch. You answer a quick questionnaire about your interests and how you spend your time, and then they'll match you in small groups of 6 to 8 at a brunch spot in San Francisco. Get a free entry into a brunch now by signing up at 500brunches.com and using the code DATEABLE.
If you didn't know already, we have a revamped website with articles, videos, and content all about modern dating. You can also find our premium Y series where we dissect, analyze, and offer solutions to some of the most common dating conundrums. We've had some great feedback about how actionable these episodes are. So check them out on our website or iTunes Music. Also, visit the site today to see the latest about coaching, where we connect you with Dateable approved experts to help with everything from dating profile reviews, coaching, and even gathering real feedback about your dating style in a personalized and affordable way. To connect with us, visit datablepodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, all under Dateable Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and auto-download the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast player so you never miss an episode.